tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So on this Saturday night, good news is that Ajahn Tirodhamo arrived today, so he'll be with us for about 2.5 months, to May 11th. Fortunately, Ajahn just had a whole day, I think workshop or something, 9 to 3, so he's having a rest this evening, but tomorrow maybe after they'll be getting food, everybody can be get ready to pay respects to Ajahn Tirodhamo, be good. So I think next Saturday, Ajahn will be giving the talk. For tonight, I thought maybe we just kind of going over the theme of the Eightfold Path, continuing, what does it mean to do so, like the practice. Sometimes we focus on the practice, and sometimes we have a very narrow focus, always thinking on, meditation, watching the breath, or keep the mantra going. But actually the practice is much more wider than that. The main word is bhavana, which is, kind of cultivation of mental states. And it's something that we can do all throughout the day. And it's cultivating wholesome states, creating conditions where wholesome state arises in the mind, or if it's already wholesome, to increase and to maintain them, or the opposite, to see, to creating conditions that unwholesome states decrease. If they're already in the mind, they're decreasing. If they're having a rise, for them not to arise in the future. Right? And that's not something that we do throughout, awakened moments. Not something that we just about watching the breath or doing the mantra. And that's why in the forest tradition, like Ajahn Chah say, the saying goes, the devil is in the details. That's why there are thousands of rules about, how to wear your robe, how to eat, how you take care of the bowl, there's a lot of mindfulness around it. Because it's cultivation of, clear comprehension, satipanya, that Ajahn Chah talks about a lot. It's awareness, where am I and what should I be doing? And I think that's where it's a great training, especially for young monks for the first 5 years, to stay in the community, to learn to live each other, to learn to, look after the senior monks, to learn how to take care of the bowl, look after the robes, look after the kutis. Yeah. Because sometimes, people read a couple of books on Buddhism, they think, I'm heading for Nibbana only. But they don't have an idea what that's about. And it's not always about, sitting and watching the breath. It's so much more, just the thing, where's my bowl and robe? How do I tie it properly? How to wash it properly? Where is it, How to sun it? And this thing that we do day in, day out, but it just keeps us grounded. Always know, time and place. That way, this is kind of communal living, learning to kind of live in harmony, be a productive member of the society, the group, and also helping each other. So it also takes us out from a kind of self-absorbed world that we always live in from time, that we sometimes get pulled into habits of in our own mind, our own dialogue, things are happening, or rather doing what we want to do instead of what the communal is good for the community. So it's this kind of the day-to-day thing, looking after the toilet, looking after the monastery, looking after the sala, cleaning up after the meal, looking around, see what needs to be done. There's quite an art, quite a skill to do that. And it's also just to check our attitude. What's the attitude of, being helpful, looking around, or is it attitude of, doing as little as we can so that we can get back a kuti and do the real practice, the meditation. And you can see that if you have that mental thing of, just doing as little and trying to get the maximum return, it's over time you'll find that that's not exactly wholesome. You see clearly. And that's, sometimes a lot of people miss that. A lot of people read the books and say, the Buddha, kind of meditating in the forest all by himself, know, what's the point of, you know, doing the 5 years here? I can just go straight to the forest, go to Sri Lanka, Thailand, and just go in a cave, watch a few breaths, become enlightened, go back, write a book. It's not quite how that works. And sometimes people aren't ready. A lot of time meditation is quite refined, actually. And sometimes we read the books and, yeah, Buddha gives a few words or something, and then people, you know, become enlightened very quickly. But these days, you know, but you'll see if you can read a lot of the teaching of the Buddha, you see that it's much more wider. And there's, you know, the cultivation of virtue, cultivation of, you know, harmlessness, the cultivation of generosity, cultivation of, you know, kind of living a pure life, cultivation of wholesome intention. And all that is a lot of, you know, kind of preparation that needs to be done before one sits down to watch the breath. And usually that's why sometimes, you know, in meditation retreats, it is usually the old ladies that get really good meditation, because a lot of time they've been spending their whole life, you know, looking after monastery, looking after monks, just having really wholesome states, you know, no major views and opinions, they haven't read a lot of books, but just kind of very soft beings, very just very helpful, does what needs to be done, always joyful, always happy. And Buddha says, you know, samadhi comes from a happy state. Samadhi is not something, sometimes you read, you know, something that you force your will on. It's not an act of willpower. It's not an act of, you know, intense effort to focus on the breath. The breath just naturally settles. And it's something that you can watch, you know, easily. It's not something that you have to struggle with for a long, long time, if it's true samadhi. Of course, in the beginning, yeah, you just have to keep bringing the mind back to the breath, bringing the mind back to the meditation object. But over time, if it's, you know, kind of when the mind begins to settle down, it's much more of a natural process, much more kind of a letting go, a being at ease, just watching, and things settle by themselves. It's not so much you're in there doing it, kind of managing, arranging, forcing, pulling, pushing. Those, you know, slight adjustment may be useful in the beginning, but as soon as, you know, the practice starts to take off, meditation starts to deepen, it's much more of organic and natural process that happens by itself. But in order to prepare for that, like I said, it's always have to have strong sati, strong, you know, mindfulness and clear comprehension, you know, and that's why the this ability just to be aware of what's happening and to where you know what you're doing. And that's why, you know, there are so many minor rules, rules of etiquette, how to eat properly, not to chew your food, not to spill things around, the water everywhere, watching, you know, how you sit in relation to the monks or the people around you, you're not encroaching on one person, you're not squeezing too much, and to eat mindfully, you know, practice of eating, just eating quietly, not talking, not reading, not kind of doing other things. Yeah, so there's all this kind of lots of preparation that goes out throughout the day. But sometimes we get overlooked. I think it's just, you know, just straighten, watch my breath, close my eyes, and blink on the world. And we do have to be careful. And sometimes it's kind of, I was telling somebody, sometimes it's ironic, but sometimes it does. The practice is sometimes seems to be a very kind of self-obsessed. Like me and my practice look down. And it's sort of like that. Sometimes when you meditate, you do have to kind of watch the breath and be restrained and, you know, not go out too much outside. But as you progress deeper, the result of that practice is actually the opposite, that you don't get so self-centered, that you have this empathy towards being around you. That because the mind clears up, you understand, you see that there's a whole world around you, and there's, you know, people, we live in a world with other people, that there are beings around us that suffer, there are beings around us that also needs respect and love and care. And as you understand suffering through meditation, the meditation, yeah, you can kind of relate to these people. You feel much more part of the human race, part of the community where you're at. And it's funny, yeah, the more you spend alone, the more the mind becomes more clear. You have this more kind of empathy being part of the world. And sometimes it can be the opposite. You know, we live and our mind is distracted. We can live next to people, but sometimes you never talk to your neighbor for 20 years, because we all live in our very kind of solipsistic kind of world. So especially in the digital age, you know, you all kind of go in your house, lock, close the door, get in the internet, and you can talk to people across the world, but we don't know who our neighbors are. So in a way, and it's kind of an ironic way, yeah, through the internet, we're actually more disconnected. We think we're connected, you know, with the world around us, but because of the way it works, we don't really interact with each other in a meaningful way, just, you know, kind of over the, just digitally. Sometimes there is a feeling of disconnectedness to the real world around us. So it is through, you know, and that's the way to kind of watch the result of the progress of your practice. It's not always about how quiet the mind is. It's not always about how bright the light is or what visions you see and what sound or how long you can sit or how many hours you put in. Sometimes it is, you know, what happens when you get up from the seat. There should be feelings of, you know, gratitude, feeling of acceptance. When the mind is peaceful, this natural wholesome state arises naturally. There should be less, you know, feeling of, you know, kind of stillness, feeling of appreciation, feeling of love, metta for things around you, people around you, beings around you. Those are the natural kind of results of a still mind, when the mind is clear. And if those don't arise, then you should question, you know, what is it? A lot of people do come to, you know, monasteries, do come to meditation retreat centers, and there's sometimes such kind of disembodied feeling that, you know, if I just focus on the breath enough, using the force, I'll get there, I'll be happy somehow. If suffering enough, sometime in the future I'll be happy. And I don't know if this is kind of PC to say to a lay person, but in most monasteries, Bodhinyana, Nanacha, no difference. During every rain retreat, somebody goes funny. It's not real rain retreat unless someone goes funny. And then sometimes that's because, obviously, you know, it's that's fine. So some people who've been in Bodhinyana probably know, can attest to all the interesting things that happens during the rain retreat. And sometimes that's because, yeah, of the intense atmosphere, obviously, you know, the focus is on meditation. There's no work, not much distraction, obviously. There's no music, entertainment. So there is, you know, a certain pressure. But also, it's sometimes it's a misunderstanding that, yeah, you know, meditation is about, you know, allowing things to happen, not kind of forcing the mind. You force the mind too much, that's what happens. It cracks up, and you start to, you know, do, you know, weird things. Just remember, it's not a kind of a disembodied feeling. Meditation, if anything, it's a feeling of unification, feeling of, you know, being, and it, yeah, and also the same with kind of understanding and the Dhamma, understand the sense of non-self, that you have to kind of pick things up first before you let them go. You have to have a healthy sense of self before you can realize non-self and understand non-self. It's not like, oh yeah, I don't really relate to these people anyway, so I'm going to go for the non-self and not really part of it and just drift off. That's usually a recipe for, you know, a psychotic episode. So it's, you know, and it's the same. It's, you know, you have to understand where our attachment is before you can let them go. And it's through being opening to, obviously, our strength, you know, our aspiration, but also opening to the darker side, the petty side, the childish side, the selfish side of us. They are there, but we have to recognize, we have to allow them to come up. Sometimes, you know, we think, we misunderstand as Buddhists, you know, as practitioner. I should always love everybody, I should always be at peace, I should always smile, I should always be happy all the time. And then we have feelings of, you know, suffering, feeling anxiety come up, feeling of jealousy or whatever, and then we don't admit to it. We start to rationalize it, we start to suppress it. But that's the thing, is they're still there. And they will come up in different ways, sometimes in very kind of destructive ways. But that's what hopefully the practice of meditation is, the settling down and allowing these things to come up. And then to, you know, accept them, to learn from them, to embrace them, to understand that they're just part of the human nature, that we have positives, we have positive states of mind, and we have negatives. Ultimately, it's non-self. It's not something that determines, defines us. It moves, it changes on its own. And the more we kind of allow these kind of emotional states up, the more we can try to learn from them, then they do kind of dissipate. They disappear on their own. But the more we suppress, the more we ignore them, more than push them down, you're saying that they'll come up more stronger later on. And it's always the practice like, you know, sensitivity. The sensitivity to what's happening inside of us, but also sensitivity to what's happening around us. That, you know, not always gets consumed by our own agendas, what we need to do. But to understand, yeah, there are beings around us. They have their sufferings. They have their wants, their needs. And that, you know, it's for each and every one of us to try to kind of lessen the amount of suffering around us in ways, you know, in however ways we can. And that's actually, you'll find that as you become more sensitive, as you become more aware, more feel more connected, you can be, you know, kind of, and it's much a much better state of mind of, you know, instead of, you know, what can I get from this situation? What can I get from the world? You know, how can I give? How can I make things better? It's much more beautiful. And when you sit down, you're not asking anything from the meditation. You're not asking anything from the breath. You're not asking anything from the world around you. You're just ready to stay there to receive. Because it's the same mind that we, same momentum, how we relate to the world outside of the sitting meditation. It's also how we relate to the meditation object. So you're always kind of looking to help, to accept, to forgive, or to give, to give forgiveness. Then it's the same, you know, when we sit down the mind, there's not so much confrontation, not so much things that we need to manage and build and make right. You're just happy with whatever's at the present moment. You're tired, yeah, just happy just to be sitting. The tiredness, tired of the body, it's not the end of the world. The breath is rough, it's coarse. You can't find it. It's not the end of the world. You patiently wait, you know, struggling, striving, wanting things, managing, forcing, willing things to happen. And unless we demand from the world around us, unless we demand from ourselves, unless we demand from the meditation object, and things begin to settle down. Things begin to calm down on its own. And we realize, oh, okay, this is what the Buddha said about non-self. That's what the Buddha said, you know, things are impermanent, they come and they go, outside by wishes. But it starts out, you know, kind of being aware, you know, moment by moment, where am I? And starting out to relating with a kind of a wholesome attitude to the world around us. Attitude of kind of looking, learning, acceptance, of forgiving, of being helpful where we can. It's the attitude of giving, always giving. Giving up our ideas, our views and opinions, if that's helpful, or when you find it's not helpful. Giving forgiveness to people who annoyed us, who does us wrong, who can't wash the spittoon properly, who doesn't close the door, whatever, let the rat in, it's okay. Or whatever, or whoever broke different things, who ate the last chocolate. But it's this, the day-to-day stuff. That's where you find out our attachment is. It's the kind of, yeah, kind of very kind of ordinary interaction, really, that you can see the practice. That's why you see the wisdom of the Buddha really making a rule. The monks and nuns, you know, young junior monks and nuns should not go by themselves. That they should stay with the teacher for 5 years. And then after that, you know, you're ready for kind of the forest or deep meditation. Because, you know, and in many places in the sutta, the Buddha said, you know, if you're not ready, you go to the forest, you can go crazy. Obviously, in these days, they, you know, might be drastic. Most of you don't go crazy. People may not go anywhere, but they might not make the best time of either, make best use of it. Because you do have to be ready for meditation. But it's always not just about strictly, you know, samadhi, strictly about meditation. It's just, you know, just kind of have this a wider focus of cultivating wholesome states. So obviously, even when you're not in the monastery, you're outside, working, cultivating, how can I have a wholesome state relating to this situation, to my co-worker, my boss, you know, my kids, my family, whatever. You know, what is the wholesome thing to do? What is the helpful thing to do? And I was kind of relating to that. I thought, I wish I could have some free time so I can meditate. I wish I could run off to the monastery for a weekend and run away from there's so much confusion, distractions. It is helpful to have a quiet place. But a lot of time, real peace is how we relate to the world. And that's the thing. When the Buddha is around, there's, war, there's hunger, famine, injustice, violence. He still became enlightened. He didn't run away. He relate to it with deep peace and wisdom. And that's where true peace comes from. Initially, it's helpful to have a quiet place externally. But the main thing is the internal peace. How do we carry that around? And as you see, people can make lots of problems in the monastery. They run from one place to the next. That is not right. Something happened. This is not wrong. I got to go to the next monastery. And then they get moving around. And really, as Ajahn Chah's famous phrase is, the shit is in your pocket. Wherever you go, it stinks. You think, I go there, a bit better, but no, I go there, better. No. It's like the dog with mange. He goes in the forest, it's still scratchy. He goes out in the city, it's still scratchy. He goes in the temple, it's still scratching away. Because a lot of times the dissatisfaction is inside of us. But sometimes it's easy to externalize it, to look outward and to blame, this is that. And there's some, obviously, truth to that. But really, if you go to enough places, you find there's never a perfect monastery. But most places are good enough. You can wash your breath. There's sufficient food. There's sufficient, accommodation for you to practice. Lots of things can happen outside that are less than ideal, but that's okay. You don't have to get involved. You can don't have to have strong views and opinions about what happened. Take sides on who's right and who's wrong or whatever. You can just go back to your hut and leave that behind. And that's kind of over my years training as a monk. And that's the thing, is it's only when you stand still, when you don't move around, that you start to see, the mind starts to open up. You start to learn much more about yourself and the world around you. That's the irony. Before, like I said, I was traveling as a layperson, different cities all the time. Mind wasn't clear. You just, after a while, things became a blur. And you weren't learning anything. It was all, you're traveling to these supposed to be great places or whatever, as a tourist. After a while, they're all the same. It's just another building, very ornate building, another restaurant, another food, more people, another beach, resort. So it's just the same. But then you stay in one place, Wapananacha, you stay in one place at Bodhinyana Monastery. Mind becomes more clear, opens up. It's amazing what you can learn. And it's the same thing every day. You see the same people, same monks sitting to your left, same monks sitting to the right, same food, same routine. But every day is so different. Every day you see, the different, how you relate to things, how you interact, and how you relate to the people around you who are the same. Sometimes you love them, think, they're the most wonderful people in the world. Other days it's like, oh my God, this is hell on earth. How did I get stuck with these people? And it's the same people. They haven't changed much. It's just your state of mind. And after you realize, it isn't so much out there. It's in here. And that's where you begin to learn about what the mind is about. Learn to this about the thinking mind, how much suffering we can heap on ourselves if we're not clear. We attach to these emotional states. We attach to the views and opinions of different things. But it takes this kind of interest. It takes the ability just to kind of keep going back to the present moment, keep reestablishing, keep asking yourself, where am I? What am I doing? Where am I? And how can I cultivate a wholesome state of mind? Where am I? And how can I help? Whatever. Situation. There's no one around, you can help yourself. Be kind to yourself. Be your best friend. You don't need people around. Other people around that you can help, you do what you can. And it takes kind of one step at a time, one moment at a time, one day at a time, Nothing kind of have a major goal or agenda, where you should be, how deep the meditation is. All that is more thinking, expectations, and wanting, and yearning. And over time, you'll see that, you know, these natural states, these wholesome states of, you know, connection, feeling of acceptance, of gratitude, starts to arise naturally. You feel, yeah, okay, this is the, you know, you're going the right direction. Things are beginning to happen on their own. Not because of the striving that you made, not because of you forced it. But things, you know, the mind starts to open up. Things start to come together. There's this kind of deep peace that comes from inside, not from outside. And sometimes wisdom arises. You see, you know, just it's a changing state of mind. So you don't buy into different states. You think someone's wonderful, you say, yeah, yeah, okay, sure, not sure. Like Ajahn said, if someone's terrible, you're never very annoying, not sure. These things changes. But it only changes when you have a clear mind, and when you stand still, you can see how much changes around you and inside you. But if you're moving, and the world around you is also moving, it's very difficult. You have a clear, you just see clearly. Like I said, on this Friday, Saturday night, of kind of offer some encouragement just to kind of view kind of a different focus on the practice as cultivation of wholesome states during the waking moments. That's not about sitting in the sala with meditation. It's not about, you know, having long retreats. It's in how can I cultivate my mind moment by moment, day by day, in all four posture. And we can always do that. You don't even have to be in a monastery. You don't have to become a monk or a nun. You can do it anytime, anywhere. And that's something that the Buddha left behind us. Yeah. So I leave that for your reflection tonight.
Andamayam ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karang dadama se sadhu sadhu sadhu.
Sūpātihāno bhagavato asāvaka-saṅgho saṅghāṁ namaḥ.